Welcome to the Midday. I'm Norman Gilliland here in our Buck studio now for this hour of the Midday with two guests, one of whom is going to be working a lot harder than the other. Mike Ryan is here. Welcome to the Midday.
Thank you for having me.
I don't usually ask. This is a very personal question to start with, but you're what, 15?
16.
Oh, you're already 16 years old now. But your harpsichord is a lot newer than that.
Yeah.
We'll get to that in a minute. And also here, your teacher, Trevor Stevenson.
Good morning.
Welcome back.
Good afternoon.
We just crossed the line there. We crossed the line often in this show, actually. Well, before we hear the sound of your harpsichord, Mike, I have to ask some more pretty obvious questions. Why did you go from, you know, one year you're making Pinewood Derby cars, and then a couple of years later you're building a harpsichord? That's kind of a quantum leap, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I've always been really interested in woodworking and music, you know, the creative side of me and the more engineering, mechanical side of me. And I guess, really, when I started building the harpsichord, it was really the marriage between these two sides of my interests. And, you know, when I do a lot of learning, a lot of reading, and talking to people who are experts on the subject, and one thing led to another, and that's really what led to this project.
Did you play the piano before you got into the harpsichord? How did you actually make that particular move into the harpsichord?
Well, yeah, I've always played piano for pretty much as long as I can remember, and as much as I love the piano, there's certain things that I can do very well and certain things that I simply can't do. And after hearing some period recordings and stuff on authentic instruments of Baroque music, Baroque and even classical for that matter, you know, I came to realize that the composers were writing for these instruments and just they were going for that sound. And that sound you can't really obtain with instruments of today. And so really that's what, after I heard that, I just, something said to me, I have to have that sound. I have to become part of it. And so that's how that started.
And what prompted you to actually build your own? that's a far different thing.
Right. Had you already said you wanted to build one before your dad showed up at my house asking for the plans?
But. Well, yeah. Before that, I'd built a clavichord, a smaller instrument that was simpler to build, but you know, still some of the same things. So I had a little bit of experience before that. I guess what really led me to build it was that I wanted to become part of not only playing that sound, but making that sound, really getting my hands into it and really becoming part of starting from pile of boards to really getting to the actual music itself. And so really becoming part of the process, too, was important to me.
Right. It changes your relationship when you've made it from scratch. It changes the way you play.
You know, feel much more, no pun intended, attuned to the instrument.
Sure, yeah.
Zen in the art of harpsichord maintenance.
but no, it was, where do you start? I mean, is there a blueprint for harpsichords?
Well, pretty much, yeah. This instrument here was, I based it off of one of Trevor's plans for an instrument that he has, built by Mr. Norman Shepherd of Middleton, Wisconsin, who I should mention has been a great help for me and teaching me the parts of woodworking that are really specific to harpsichord making and really how you can get a good sound out of the wood and stuff like that. Anyway, what were you saying? I'm sorry.
No, well, the wood itself is actually part of the sound, then.
Definitely, yeah. I mean, there's a certain woods give certain characteristics that I'll show you in a second, but the two registers on this harpsichord are made out of different, the bridges that accompany them are made out of different woods, and cherry for the longer bridge and for the shorter one using beechwood, and both of those woods, they basically emphasize the natural characteristics of each of the registers in the instrument. Mm-hmm. In addition, the soundboard is made out of spruce that I actually had imported from Switzerland that's grown in the Alps, and this stuff is really amazing. It gives an excellent sound when you tap it, and it's you can really just tell this instrument loves the sound of that wood, and so wood does play a surprising amount in the role of the sound and stuff.
Right. Who did you buy that wood from, the Alp stuff?
Yeah, there's
the Italian company?
No, a Swiss company. Oh, okay. I forget their name at the moment, uh-huh. But they're an operation out in Switzerland right in the Alps, and they go out in basically their backyard and and just... Mm-hmm.
Chop down another one. We've got another order.
Yeah, another order. And all of this made possible by the Internet. Right?
Is that typical of harpsichords from, say, the 18th century, that the wood comes from various places?
Yeah, the sources we have from that time, when they talk about where you get your soundboard material and all that, many of them say, go up into the highest mountains, right? And that's where the trees, they grow slowly. The trees go slowly up there, so you get very tight rings in it, which gives you a kind of a very brilliant and honest type of sound. So,
well, let's hear some of that sound.
Yeah,
you have some Handel to get things started?
Yeah, I'll start off with two pieces of Handel.
And what are these two pieces going to be?
All right, I'll start off with Sonatina in B-flat major, written by Handel. And then following that, I'll do a minuet in G minor. And listen to the tone color in these two pieces. I'll explain that after I play these two, but you'll hear something definitely different, and I'll get into that. So, again, starting with the Sonatina in B-flat major. And on to the minuet in G minor.
Now, when you went from these are both pieces by Handel, Mike. You went from the Sonatina in B-flat major to the minuet in G minor. You pulled at a little tasseled knob there on the right-hand side of your harpsichord. There are three of them, I think. What do they do?
Well, yeah, good question. On this instrument, there are three registers, as they're called. And basically in a harpsichord, they're usually sets of strings. In this case, there's actually two strings per note and three registers, but that's an unusual characteristic in this instrument. For the most part, usually there's the same number of registers as there are sets of strings. And basically what these do is they allow you to change the tone color by coupling different sets of strings and having certain strings plucked at a different spot along the string. For example, plucking farther out toward the string will yield a more, say, a rounded tone, similar to that of a flute. Mm-hmm. Well, as you go closer to the nut, which is basically the front termination point of the string, it's like a secondary bridge, The tone there will be much more nasal and crisp, much like that of an oboe. And so really, the harpsichord, although it doesn't do dynamics in the same sense that a modern piano does, it has the ability to give you different tone colors, which is part of the reason why many organists are actually harpsichord players as well, because harpsichord is actually much like a strung organ in a way. Mm-hmm.
Would you show them the difference between, just in the opening of that minuet, show the difference between the front eight and the back eight?
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
Just so people can hear those, the two completely different colors that you can get off the same string by plucking it at different points.
So we'll start off with the back 8 foot. I should also mention 8 foot comes from organ terminology, which basically is referring to the lowest pipe length. And in an organ pipe, if you half the length of it, the frequency will double and the octave will go higher. And so basically that terminology, when you hear us saying 8 foot and 4 foot, we're referring to standard pitch versus an octave higher versus, and then so on. Yeah. And so anyway, to demonstrate, the back 8 foot register and the beginning of the Handel minuet in G minor. Now the front 8 foot, which again I said before, has a more nasal oboe-like sound.
It's a huge difference.
And you would use this difference for what particular purpose, though? I mean, why would a composer use one as opposed to the other?
Well, certain registers have certain characteristics, and sometimes they complement a certain piece a little more on one than another. For example, I choose to use the front 8 foot register on the minuet in G minor, simply because I think the piece has more an intimate nature to it. It kind of a little bit mysterious, but not overly. And I think that those characteristics in which Handel is writing kind of really complement the sound of that front 8 foot register. And so, you know, conversely, on certain other pieces with a more bright and lively sound, I might just choose to go for the back 8 foot, which is the more flute one, or possibly even coupled with the 4 foot, which will couple the octave, if you've ever heard that phrase.
Right.
So the composer doesn't ordinarily make those specifications. It's the call of the performer.
Right.
In most cases,
we always
yeah.
say, if you have to ask, you shouldn't be playing it. Right. So, you know, I mean, well, there's a truth to it. I mean, it's you're following your artistic instinct with it. Yeah.
Well, that's a fascinating avenue of, self-expression there on the part of the performer. It gives you some latitude.
Would you show them, just even though it's not the right stop for this piece, add the 4 foot to that, Mike, and so that you can hear what it's like with both sets of strings going even on the same piece, just
sure, yeah.
by way of demonstration. So this is adding an octave higher to the regular sound. Mm-hmm. So the people, you know, and this is kind of the with the whole band. Yes. And that makes it a more public kind of a voice.
Absolutely.
It,
yeah,
it's like adding a piccolo to an orchestra. it really makes it carry, which is good for continuo purposes, too.
Yes.
Now, the Tambourin by Rameau has, I presume, a kind of a percussive quality to it. How does that come out in the harpsichord?
Yeah, let's get to that. I always couple the back 8 foot with the 4 foot, which, again, emphasizes that percussive quality. And to demonstrate that, I'll play it for you right now.
So this is the Rameau writing a harpsichord piece imitating a tambourine. And probably a gypsy band. And,
well, the French liked that. Right. They had the kind of the lock on that particular genre, the tambourin.
Right.
definitely percussive and definitely reminiscent of a tambourine in particular. Yeah.
We always say, hang on to your wallet.
Oops.
Yeah, this is. What is it? It was a kind of a sideshow.
Sure.
Feeling to it, yeah.
We'll get to a piece that has a mysterious title in just a moment. We'll return with Mike Ryan and his harpsichord right after this on Wisconsin Public Radio. Back with Mike Ryan and the harpsichord that he has built, and Trevor Stevenson is also here. And this piece, I've always been intrigued by the title. It's by François Couperin, one of the great 18th century French composers, or one of a family of composers, in fact. And why these mysterious barricades? What does that mean, do you think? I mean, do we know even what it means?
You know, the title has mysterious in it even. You know, it can be interpreted so many ways. And me personally, I see it as not really a literal meaning, but more of the feeling that the words give to you. I mean, if you hear the mysterious barricades, in my opinion, just hearing that, and of course it's different in English than French, so I'm only seeing half the picture, but it kind of paints a picture in my mind, and that's the kind of picture that I try to portray in the music that I play when I play this piece. Yeah. So.
All right. Well, let's have that.
The thing past which you cannot go, right? It's another way to look at it. Right?
Whatever that thing may be. Mysterious Barricades of François Couperin.
Yes, right. Le Grand.
Well, Mike, so you play the harpsichord, you built the harpsichord, but you're also a triple threat because inevitably it would seem that a guy like you would also compose for the harpsichord.
Yeah, I do. And I do compose for the harpsichord. It's my instrument, really, my main instrument that I play. And so I've always liked composing. And, you know, I guess the way I see it is with music, it's a it's basically a triangle or pyramid, however you want to see it. There's three sides, being the person who's made the instrument or the instrument itself, the composer who wrote the music, and the performer who is obviously playing the music. And really, both all three sides of that triangle tend to influence each other. And I guess being interested in all those three areas and wanting to become part of them, when I write music, play it on an instrument that I've built, and perform it myself, it really gives me control of all three aspects. And I really just appreciate having that kind of influence over the music which I play. And so, yeah, that's what leads me to write my own music.
Yeah. And I would imagine that it would be inevitable that you would, some of that music that you would write would be minuets. I mean, that's kind of the dance of the 18th century, isn't it?
Yeah, I like minuets. Who couldn't like a minuet?
I think we should be dancing the minuet again, right. Bring that back. Yeah. But in the meantime, what does yours sound like?
All right, here's two of mine, and I've already talked to you about the registration changes, you know, with the 8-foot and the 4-foot, but I'm going to bring to your attention another feature called the buff stop. Buff coming from buffalo, or basically a buffalo type of leather, which was originally added to the strings when engaged. And this feature basically gave a muted kind of pizzicato sound, somewhat reminiscent of that of a lute. And on this instrument, it features a buff stop. And a unique feature about this buff stop, which was more common, I guess, among the late Renaissance and early Baroque instruments, the Flemish school especially, is they incorporated what's called a split buff, meaning that you can add this pizzicato feature to certain parts of the keyboard and not to others. And this led to almost a duet sound, mm-hmm. like you have basically a duet playing with another instrument, mm-hmm. Like I mentioned before, and that can also be influenced by which register you're choosing to play. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I'll start off with one of my minuets, and I'm going to, again, feature that buff stop, and in this case, I'll be buffing the lower half of the keyboard, and the upper half of the keyboard will just play the single 8-foot string unbuffed.
That's lovely, stately minuet. You just call it minuet number one, or
I'm not really sure. I just call it.
Wait and see how many you compose before you name that.
Pretty much, yeah.
That's the music the nice long retard you take at the end sounds like the wind up a music box running down.
True.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great. Yeah, it makes one go to sleep. Right? It's beautiful.
And so, how many minuets have you written?
I'm not sure, really. I mean, more than the two that I've played, you know, as soon as I try to list them off, I realize which ones I've forgotten to mention. And so, but I tend to write them frequently. I mean, it's nice and fun to write them, really, because they're you know, they're simple pieces usually in their nature, but at the same time, you can do so much with them. It's like a blank canvas in a way.
Well, we pick up another dance that was popular with Mike Ryan in the 18th century, and that's the gavotte.
Well, I wrote another minuet too that I plan to play today. Do we have time for that?
We have. Let's hear the second minuet and
yeah,
then
sure.
The gavotte. Contrasting minuet. And what's the difference between a minuet and a gavotte? Gavotte a little more up-tempo or no?
Oh, yeah. The gavotte's definitely a contrast. That's part of the reason I chose it for this program. And a lot faster pace, again, with the back 8-foot couple to the 4-foot for that big band kind of sound. So,
and it's in a duple meter as opposed to the minuet in triple.
Sure. So. That's perfectly charming.
I know. This is some like a found Bach manuscript.
Well,
right?
Yeah. So many ever tempted to Mike to like to kind of like, what does this sound like if I put it in the context of a French suite or something by Bach? You know, how well would it fit? Or you're tempted to create any little forgeries like that. I mean, it's been done before.
That's right.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, I've always considered, lumping pieces together and putting them into suites, but I'm not sure. I sometimes get inspiration for something that's not really relevant to the other piece, and so And then when I do come up with something, sometimes it's at a later period. So as one single unit, I haven't really thought of that, but it's on my to-do list, and so I hope to get that done.
Well, you know, there's a story about the pianist Paderewski, one of the great pianists, who actually for a time was also the prime minister of Poland in the early 20th century, and he used to perform when he was a young man. He would perform, just play the piano for a couple of elderly friends, and they always wanted to hear Mozart, He got kind of tired of just playing nothing but Mozart. And so he composed a minuet of his own. And then one evening when he was playing for the elderly gentleman, they said, you know, Mozart, we've got to have Mozart. There's nothing, anything comparable to Mozart. Play us something. So he played his minuet. And they said, oh, you know, isn't that Mozart wonderful? Could anybody compose anything that good today? And he said, well, yeah, actually, I did.
I did. And they were
kind of sore about it at first, but then every time he came, they wanted to hear that, and it became a very famous minuet, Paderewski. So, you know, you might consider that kind of skullduggery sometimes. I'm sure you could pull it off. Just before 1 o'clock, after we've had a good deal more music with my guest today, Mike Ryan, who at the age of 16, has built his own harpsichord. And I heard you say, Mike, that it took maybe over, you did this over the course of maybe a year and a half, so that means you actually started it when you were 14.
Mm-hmm. Correct, yeah.
He did, right. And I have to tell this story. His dad showed up at my door saying, can I borrow the plans for your Flemish harpsichord? And sure. And so he ran off to Kinko's and copied this huge, 6-foot-long piece of paper, like in the architectural drawings, where they have a machine that will copy huge drawings, and they put it under the Christmas tree. And
even that must have taken up a lot of room, I would think. Well,
I think he rolled it up, right? Yeah. Anyway, so that's the ultimate Christmas gift, right? Yeah. And then a year later, it was up on its feet. The harpsichord was,
And this takes a good deal of precision. I mean, it looks beautiful, too, but in order to make every string, every key sound just right, you used, traditionally it would be crow feathers, but you decided to go with another bird.
Yeah, I used turkey feathers on this instrument simply because I guess I don't really have the heart to use actual crow feathers, even though it's often used today and they do give a good sound. But turkey feathers work also, and they have a nice kind of snap to the sound. And that their modern plastic counterparts, which are often used in harpsichords built today, I don't really the traditional quill actually, in my opinion, gives a better sound. It's because really to sum it up, it has more of a snapping quality to it. In other words, there's a direct, distinct pluck with a quill, and while the plastic kind of tends to move a little slower and drag on the string, possibly killing some of the overtones that would otherwise be present. And although, of course, people use plastic for a reason, you basically put it in there and it's set.
For better or worse.
Low maintenance. I always thought, with the plastic quills, the sound, that it doesn't really have a shape. But somehow when you use this organic material, there's a kind of an hourglass shape to the sound that where all the overtones, they coalesce, they come together, and it's sweet. Which, if you read the writings about music from the 18th century, it was sweet, so.
And speaking of sweets, we have the movements from the Fifth French Suite by Bach, and we'll start with three of those. And which three?
Oh, all right. We'll start with the Allemande. Following that, the Courant, and then after that, we're doing the Sirbant. So, starting with the Allemande right now.
A German dance.
Thank you.
So that was the Saraband. Before that was a Courant.
Yes.
Which would be literally a running dance. And then we started with the Allemande, all from the French suite. Number 5 by Bach. And that, I think, so far as I know, Trevor, Mike, is another kind of mysterious title. Do we know why he called them French suites or English suites?
I think the titles are not confirmed. He didn't publish any of these, and these come down in, I think, manuscripts or even copies from the students, but Bach never actually wrote French suite on them. I think the tradition in the family was that the CPE, Carl Philipp Emanuel, said these are suites sort of in the French style. Somebody said it early on, but I don't think we have the master's blessing on these titles or the English suite, you know. But I think they're close enough, you know. I mean, so there's some reason why it sticks. And then there's a set of English suites, too, and then partitas.
Wait till they find the German suites, though. That's the really good stuff if we're talking about Bach.
We do know that Bach gave these pieces to his students after they had done the 2- and 3-part inventions. Then they went to this, and then if they got through the suites, then they went to the well-tempered clavier. That was his top drawer stuff, and he usually went in that order.
He had the lesson plan all mapped out. Some dropped out earlier than...
Right. He was organized.
But even his second wife, Anna Magdalena, he had the notebook of pieces that he wrote for her, and then we don't know how far she got, I guess, as a keyboard player.
She was a great singer, you know. She was.
And so as was his first wife, yes.
The late Maria
Barbara.
Right. I mean, and you know, and it's a little bit about key color here. In G major, it's a key of I would always call it a key of innocence. It has is a very distilled quality, and they often tune the keyboard so that G major had a very pure sound, like C major. But for some reason, G major comes off as a lighter a foot even than C major. And Mike has tuned this in an 18th century what we call a modified mean tone. It's a kind of the common tuning for most household music of this time. And it's not even a well temperament. It's not even, you know, pushing the envelope toward the 19th century. You can't play in all keys here, but the keys you do play in are really sweet, as you can hear in that beautiful Saraband.
Let's say you have another Gavotte, right? This one by Bach from that same suite.
Oh, we do, yeah. And this is the fourth movement of the fifth French suite in G major. And I'll do this one, again, with the back 8-foot register coupled with the 4-foot for the kind of the larger kind of effects, which I find interesting on this piece because the piece is kind of – it's a light piece in a way. I mean, it has its fair tempo, but it's kind of light-footed in a way, which is which I think really, and that characteristic of it, I think really is complemented by coupling the octave and giving it that quick attack and the sound. So here we go with the Gavotte.
Yeah, the Goldberg variations, I think, are always here. They were written much later, but it's the same key, and he even modulates the same way. And
leads me to one kind of more general question, and that is about the instrument itself. That is designed after what?
This instrument is designed after original Dutch Flemish instrument, really, after the maker Couchet, which were part of the Rucker's family of harpsichord builders. And the Rucker's harpsichords, you know, the same as the Couchet, really, just the name changes through marriage and family, things like that. But for the most part, they're really the same instrument, construction-wise, sound-wise. And anyway, so yeah, this instrument is built after that school of instrument, the harpsichord building. And... You know, Trevor's always told me that that the instruments are basically, they basically sound like the language of the region that they were built in. And he's completely right about that, because it kind of does sound, that kind of Dutch sound to it, you know. And,
I wish we had someone here to speak Dutch.
Yeah,
and then here,
yeah, so we'll have to work on that for next time.
Yeah. We'll ask Anton.
Yes, we'll get a roving Dutchman to come in and give us a comparison. Now, in the scheme of things, I mean, the harpsichord, as we've implied, I think, evolved over the course of decades, and they got really quite sophisticated toward the end, the very end of the 18th century. They were competing with the pianofortes, in a sense.
Right, lots of bells and whistles they were putting on.
Yeah, they could, as this one can, to some extent, imitate various instruments. So if we were to say chronologically, where would this one fall?
Oh, this one's probably up. This is a 1679, so basically the end of the Rooker's Couchet, and you could tell when this instrument, although it's a single manual instrument, one keyboard, it does have three registers, which for this type of instrument is
kind of elaborate.
Feature.
Yes, uh-huh.
And though you could tell that by on this specific instrument by having the two 8-foot registers share the string, they're going for the same sound, you know, with two strings per every note that you know, the traditional Rooker's harpsichord had, while still kind of being compatible with the times as they were changing and tastes were changing and people were favoring larger, more, more, I guess, what's the word, you know?
Just more complex and more combinations
more
possible. One thing
exactly,
that's an indicator of how this instrument is trying to keep up with a new trend in music at the end of the 17th century is that the bass is chromatic all the way down.
Oh, yeah.
Harpsichords before this generally have what's called a short octave in the bass, which means that they don't have a low E flat, they don't have a low C sharp. Those keys didn't exist down there. And this is starting to move that out so that you can play chromatically down to the low C, which is exactly the range that Bach uses in the Well-Tempered Clavier. And so people are asking for more. They want more notes.
You it's know, like and, anything and, else, yeah. isn't it? You know, you've got to have more wheels on your car and more notes on your keyboard. And that kept right on going well into the 19th century, didn't it?
And this instrument probably weighs less than 100 pounds, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's, and by the time you get to the mid, late 18th century, 100 years later, they're weighing, pushing 200, you know, so.
Well, thanks for bringing that one in today, Mike Ryan.
Well, it was a real pleasure to be on your show.
And also thanks to Norman Shepherd for all of his, you know, he worked with Mike a lot on this, as far as, you know, advising him and just helping get over some of the bumps in the road for design.
Well, thanks also today to participants in this program behind the scenes, to one degree or other, to our engineer, Brittany DeAnda, to also to Lori Skelton there in the FM studio, and to Ryan Huber, also was ferrying your answers back and forth. It got kind of interesting for a while there.